This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com.
Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. Wherever you are and however you are listening, thank you. And this is a trial of the week, where I review a landmark article in critical care and emergency medicine that was published this month in Medical History. And we are reviewing certainly a landmark article in the world of neurocritical care and emergency medicine, the ESIT trial. And joining us to review this April trial of the week is Ashley McCormick, neurocritical care neurology pharmacist from Denver. Now, we set the scene, right, describing pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic considerations with anti-seizure medications, discussed if any of these agents are considered a standard of care, and then reviewed the research published by the two investigator teams involved in the ESIT study, the NET and PCARN groups. And Ashley and I do a deep dive into the ESIT trial itself. Were benzodiazepines given at the right dose and in a timely fashion? Did that dose cap of 75 kilos influence our results? How does the seizure cessation percentage compare to other studies? Where did the dosing scheme come from? Trial fun facts, and much more, before discussing where are we now after the ESIT publication. What are some medication safety considerations or operations considerations in a mixed adult pediatric ED? Why is this considered such a practice-changing article? What drugs would we include if we redesigned this trial today? And the episode's filled with so much more. Now, this trial was actually published after our initial Status Epilepticus episode with Corinne Berger. So come dive in, learn more about this landmark research article, an April trial of the week, starting right now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we are very lucky to be joined by our special guest for today's trial of the week, Ashley McCormick. Now, Ashley is a neurology clinical pharmacy practitioner at the Harry S. Truman VA Medical Center and a critical care emergency medicine pharmacist at Denver Health. Ashley, welcome. Thanks for joining us from the Rocky Mountain State. How are you doing today?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing well, thank you.
Well, two jobs. Like, mom, the fact that you were able to come and join us to talk about the established status epilepticus treatment trial, aka ESIT, we are very, very grateful. So, Ashley, let's kind of get right into it. And as we talk about the background or set the scene leading the time prior up to the ESIT trial, this trial focuses on three ASMs or anti-seizure medications. And do any of the three studied in this ESIT trial, do they have PK/PD properties that would make one agent superior from like a PK/PD perspective compared to the others?
So the short answer to that is yes. There are a few things we need to consider because it may not be in the way we typically think, which is in terms of clinical outcomes and efficacy. Some of the things we think about when it comes to that tend to be time to Cmax, CSF penetration, and volume and distribution. And you'll find that all three of the antiepileptics studied are pretty different when it comes to those things. But keep in mind that those types of PK/PD properties, like crossing the blood-brain barrier or time to Cmax, are all great in theory, but they don't always result in time to seizure cessation or something like that. I always use the example of IV Tylenol when it comes to thinking about this. We know it reaches peak serum concentrations much faster than oral Tylenol, but it has been shown time and time and again to have no difference. So while those are all great in theory, just kind of keep in mind that they may not result in the outcomes we want. That all being said, we also know that we consider newer antiepileptics to be less dirty. And what I mean when I say that is they're easier to dose, their kinetics are far more predictable, and a lot of that has to do with protein binding. So I think every pharmacist knows, right, that phenytoin is a pain when it comes to protein binding, adjusting doses, accounting for saturable kinetics. And in the acute setting, how much does that matter? I don't know. But when it comes, especially when you're out of that acute phase and transitioning to oral therapies, it's something that we have to think about. It also narrows our therapeutic index, right? And so when we think about drugs that are maybe safer and our margin of error is a little bit larger, our newer AEDs tend to be something that we prefer because of those PK/PD properties. Another thing to think about when you're leaving the acute phase is things like drug-drug interactions or when you're compounding multiple medications. So we know that phenytoin and valproic acid together, for example, may have some concerns with interactions.
Do we have any research showing that these advantageous either PK/PD properties or advantageous from a side effect and tolerance perspective, do we have any, does that has shown to any difference in clinical outcomes when we're using them?
Not really. And so that's why the ESETT is so important. I think that there's a lot of people who think that phenytoin has been our workhorse because it's the only one with a lot of evidence to support it. And that goes all the way back to some of our older trials, but we haven't had a lot of head-to-head things. I will say that the pediatric research is maybe a little more advanced in this area, and I would not claim to be a pediatric pharmacist by any means, but I do know that they've got a couple of trials going head-to-head. As far as safety outcomes, we know that phenytoin has a lot of concerns considering hypotension, potential arrhythmias, purple glove syndrome, which is really rare. But really devastating. And then valproic acid, people get antsy with the dosing and the infusion rates. We think of hyperammonemia when your doses get too high, platelet dysfunction. I mean, the list goes on and on. We know those to be true of individual medications. Now, when you put them head to head, we haven't really observed a lot because it hasn't really been done.
You kind of hinted at this, but let's kind of get on record with these three, right? The ESETT trial, it studied our three drugs, levetiracetam, fosphenytoin, and valproate. And from a from the perspective of the neurocritical care guidelines, was there truly a champion or first line agent? Like, you mentioned phenytoin was kind of our most studied, but was that reflected in guideline recommendations?
Yeah, so that's also great. Not entirely. So most recommendations in the neurocritical care guidelines are kind of moderate recommendations at best. Valproic acid actually may have some of the most literature followed by phenytoin and fosphenytoin over Keppra. What I will say is that anecdotally, I have seen neurologists actually get upset before the ESETT trial that Keppra was given in cases of status because it, quote unquote, lacked the data. And so if it wasn't fosphenytoin, it wasn't valproic acid, they'd actually get mad at us when they brought patients up from the ER because it wasn't studied.
So there were two investigator groups that conducted the research in the ESETT trial. And so did either of these, the NET or the PCARN group, did they have notable research into status epilepticus treatment prior to this ESETT trial?
Yeah, so I think probably the most notable overlap with the NET investigators is going to be the RAMPART trial. They talked about route of administration with benzodiazepines, and they also set a precedent for kits and tape, which you'll talk about later, and why that makes a difference. RAMPART also gave us some potential insight into endotracheal intubation when it comes to seizure care, whether or not early or later intubation makes a difference. Now, endotracheal intubation as part of seizure care has been later studied and thought not to be a great endpoint because it's so variable with practice. But I think the other important thing to note is that RAMPART gave us a lot more ammo as far as benzodiazepine dosing, appropriate dosing, giving it early, using the kits, giving it out of the hospital. All those things were really important. As far as the PCARN group, Like I said, I'm not a pediatric pharmacist, but I do know that there are a couple of really important trials that come out of them. They are the Pediatric Emergency Care Applied Research Network. They're responsible for a lot of research in the pediatric emergency world. Probably two of the most notable studies for us are the ECLIPSE and CONCEPT trials, which I don't, again, want to delve into too much, but they mostly look at phenytoin and levetiracetam in pediatric patients, and they have found no difference.
Yeah, you mentioned the Rampart trial, and it felt like that was one of the real revolutionary studies in terms of a design and enrollment kind of leading into this, our trial of the week, the ESIT trial. So the reason we're here, let's get into it a little bit. The randomized trial of three anticonvulsant medications for status epilepticus, the ESIT trial. So published in 2019 in the New England Journal of Medicine. So U.S. investigator-initiated, multicenter, blinded, response-adaptive, comparative effectiveness, randomized controlled trial. So what does that mean? Response-adaptive randomization was used to try and maximize the likelihood of identifying the most effective treatment arm. So if you look in the protocol in the supplementary materials, they show a graphic that says every 100 patients, they would essentially have an interim analysis to see if they would affect the randomization ratio based on the different efficacies of these treatments. As alluded to in the background, it was conducted by the NET and PCARN research groups. Now you may wonder, wait, NET and PCARN? That's exactly right, because the eligible patients were at least 2 years old. Now, they were treated with a quote-unquote generally accepted cumulative dose of benzodiazepines for generalized convulsive seizures lasting more than 5 minutes. So the, and then at least 5 minutes, but no more than 30 minutes after the last benzodiazepine dose. So essentially, they're including patients in whom we should be thinking about and giving a second-line anti-seizure medication. So you hear that generally accepted dose, and I'm like, I hope they define it. They do, right? So a PR or IV 10 milligram diazepam, IV 4 milligram lorazepam, or IM 10 milligram midazolam. So they could have been given in divided doses, could have been given via EMS, but that's kind of those generally accepted doses, which makes sense. Those are in line with what we would give. Key exclusion criteria, receipt of a second line anti-seizure medication pre-enrollment, those with an acute TBI, need for mechanical ventilation, post-cardiac arrest, or things that could influence these outcomes, pre-existing disease states like known liver, kidney disease, and blood glucose extremes, less than 50 or greater than 400. So randomized one-to-one-to-one to one of three treatments. So levetiracetam, 60 mg per kg up to 4.5 grams, fosphenytoin, 20 mg per kg of phenytoin equivalents up to 1.5 grams, and valproate, 40 mg per kg up to 3 grams. And these were all given over 10 minutes via IV piggyback in an infusion pump. So rescue therapy was allowed to be given for those persistent or recurrent seizures 20 minutes after the trial drug infused. Now, the other thing of note, right, they were enrolled with an exception from informed consent in this trial, right, due to the emergent nature of status epilepticus treatment. So the primary outcome was the absence of clinically apparent seizures and improving responsiveness at 60 minutes without the need for additional anticonvulsant medication. So the clinically apparent seizure and improved responsiveness, those are determined by the treating physician. So from November 2015 through October 2017, 400 enrollments from 384 patients occurred. Now in November 2017, enrollment was actually stopped due to meeting the pre-specified futility criteria at an interim analysis. So looking at these patients, about 27% of them had a protocol deviation, most commonly due to timing of benzodiazepine use. They had similar baseline characteristics about 1 hour after their seizure. A couple things, I'm sure we're going to come back to this. 50 to 60% of patients received a benzo pre-arrival, not 100%. And 85 to 88% of patients had a final diagnosis of status epilepticus. And when we look at that primary outcome, right, cessation of the status epilepticus and improvement in the level of consciousness, 60 minutes, this occurred in 47% of patients in levetiracetam group, 45% of patients in fosphenytoin, and 46% of patients in the valproate acid group. So less than 50%, no difference between them. There were some numerical differences in things like adverse effects, but no clinically significant difference. So Ashley, come back and reiterate or highlight anything of this landmark ESIT trial, especially from the perspective of a neurocritical care pharmacist.
Yeah, so I've heard a lot of takes on this. And the overall take that I've heard the most is that they were all equally bad. The overall response rate was less than 50% for all three antiepileptics. And what we found that was not different, at least statistically. We also did see, as you pointed out, that a lot of patients didn't get benzodiazepines prior to arrival. And we certainly will talk about that and how it may or may not have affected our results. The median duration of seizure at enrollment was also about an hour. So that's definitely something to take into consideration. And that another interesting thing was up to 10% were non-epileptic status. So what does that mean for us? And those are all things that we kind of have to take into consideration. But the big takeaway from the trial is that we compared three drugs, two of which have been really well studied in the literature, at least as far as neurocritical care literature goes, right? And one which we've sort of anecdotally been using, but really didn't have anything from an adult standpoint to back us up. But now maybe we see it's at least not as bad as the others, or maybe it is as bad, but it is at least as good, right?
Yeah, that's a funny takeaway. That's definitely because you could look at this glass half full and say, oh, they're all the same. But you could also look at it from that perspective and say they're all kind of maybe not what we would have expected in terms of efficacy. And I completely agree. Now let's dive in because I feel like there's a lot more questions about some of these patients, some of what happened in this trial that'll help us understand it a little bit more. So they talked about generally accepted cumulative doses of benzos. Was there any discussion on what type of doses that they got? Did they actually get the patients that did get it, did they get those recommended weight-based doses?
So overall, I think at first glance, benzodiazepine dosing looks okay, and it probably lines up with what we've been doing in clinical practice. Now, the question is, was that correct? I think that the NET investigators assumed that after the results of Rampart, higher doses would be given. And despite the trial indicating cumulative dose, they thought it would be given as a single dose and not really achieved through repeated doses. In fact, one of the authors came out in Epilepsy and Behavior in 2022 and stated that they thought that they would get higher doses of benzodiazepines up front, which, of course, as we can see, didn't really happen. And we can see that as you look at the table of cumulative doses being an average 4 to 5 milligrams, which at first glance looks okay. But when you see median duration of seizure enrollment being about an hour, you know that that's likely achieved through cumulative doses. Now, our pediatric population maybe did a little bit better in this. Those less than 32 kilograms showed a cumulative dose of 0.2 milligrams per kilogram. So assuming a 0.1 milligram per kilogram initial dose that is repeated may be a little bit more appropriate. So another thing about the benzodiazepine dosing to consider with this trial is timing. And it's another thing that comes in accordance with Rampart, right? We know that early administrations of benzodiazepine works. And a problem with this particular trial is that a lot of patients didn't get benzodiazepines before arrival. Now, we don't really know how much time that means between initiation of seizure and their arrival. But what we do know is that only about 56 to 60% of patients actually got benzos before they got there. We know that the longer someone seizes, probably the more difficult it becomes to break. It's been demonstrated time and time again that second antiepileptics and third line antiepileptics are all significantly less effective than whatever was given up front. And so it's possible that we waited too long to even give our initial doses of benzodiazepines, particularly at appropriate doses, which, as you kind of talked about, is a bummer because the Rampart trial exists and we know what the doses should be and what times they should be given. And then the question is, how did that affect our low response rates overall? The final consideration would probably be, do the changes in benzodiazepine dosing, particularly their timing, affect our primary outcome? And it sort of depends. If you look back, several patients were included in the analysis despite protocol deviations of benzodiazepine dose timing primarily. So if we gave the benzodiazepine a little bit later than we should have before we started the infusion, does that affect their improved level of consciousness at the end? We're not really sure. That's hard to tell. But it is one of those things that we have to think about.
That's a really good point bringing up that author's perspective, and it kind of shows, you know, Rampart being a pre-hospital trial, and showing that maybe in the real world, those aren't necessarily, unfortunately, the same doses that are being given. And they unfortunately, the researchers found that out after a lot of hard work on this end, because this, you know, the design and doing all of this, to have something like that happen was just such a bummer, to be honest. Like, when you look at that, because it just is something that you have to think about in the interpretation of these results. Now, the other big thing is dosing. And where did the researchers come up with a dosing scheme for the anti-seizure medications used here, right? So Keppra 60 mg per kg, fosphenytoin 20 mg per kg, valproate 40 mg per kg. So, like, where did they come up with those? Were those our common doses before this trial?
Yeah, so when you look at the AED doses that they used mostly, it seemed to be based on their need to blind appropriately. And they talk about that in their trial. They used a fill volume of 100 mils. They capped infusion rate so they could all run in over 10 minutes. That way it would be uniform and retain its blinding. And keep in mind that valproic acid and phenytoin have infusion rates that we have to follow. Keppra, we also do. Although we'll get into this, but I would argue that we can probably give Keppra in a different manner. We did cap doses at 75 kilograms. That may have been suboptimal in up to one third of the patients. And we'll talk about whether or not that means clinical outcomes, but preliminary data probably shows that we reach levels that we need to with even some of those lower doses.
So compared to some of our other published status epilepticus trials, how does this percentage of seizure, I guess you'd say composite seizure cessation, compare to others? Is this a known issue of this low percent, or is this more of a problem highlighted in this study?
I think that seizure cessation is always a little bit lower than we want it. Even in the pediatric trials, it tends to be in the 50s to 60s percent a lot of the times. One of the original trials, the VIA-QUALT trial in 1998, it compared lorazepam, phenobarbital, phenytoin, and Valium. The real takeaway from that trial is that lorazepam was better as a first-line agent. So without getting too hung up on that, but what we did find in things like phenytoin is that our response rate was about 55 to 60%. Now, the big change was probably the Rampart trial. And I know I keep going back to it, but it's a really important trial. The response rate was probably a little better. And we're talking mid-60s to 70%. Still probably not where we want it, but we did see a little bit more of a response. And again, we're comparing apples to oranges, and I realize that. But it brings up the question of early and optimal benzodiazepine dosing every time, in my opinion. And when you look at the results of the ESET trial versus the Rampart trial, that's one of my big takeaways from this, is maybe we got in our own way with the benzodiazepine administration.
Now, I always like to kind of show both sides of this. Now, the only thing that you would say from the other side is this actually more pragmatic? And unfortunately, what happens in the real world where people aren't getting those full doses of benzos up front? And I think you might say maybe. I think it affects the research that we find here, but I think that also is something that, unfortunately, especially if you work in the emergency department, that you commonly see, whether it's treatment in or pre-hospital. This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. So following from that, I guess the next logical question would be, is this the best outcome to use? Are we measuring the best outcomes in something like the ESET trial studying status epilepticus?
Yeah, so I've heard a lot of hot debate on this too. And composite outcomes are always going to be a hot topic for debate, and for pretty good reason. I understand why we use them, but then it's always important to know, how does it affect how we take these? And so a composite outcome of clinical seizures versus improved consciousness. Let's talk about one at a time. The first one is going to be clinical seizures. And I've heard a lot of commentary on this. And I'm sort of on the other side, that I think clinical seizures is an okay outcome. I know that electrographical seizures would be optimal. In a perfect world, we'd be getting EEGs on everyone that walks in the door to determine whether or not they have true epilepsy or seizures and what's going on. But it's just not feasible. And it's what we do in the ER world, right? They hit the door and we know we've got to treat them for whatever we think is going on with what we have at hand. And so I actually think it's really reasonable as far as study feasibility goes. Do I wish that we had some EEGs on a few of these patients? Absolutely. Particularly those that had seizure cessation without improved consciousness, which was about 52 patients. And so in those patients, then the question becomes, are they postictal? Are they sedated? Do they have non-convulsive epilepsy? And that's where that other endpoint of improved level of consciousness sort of comes in as a debate, right? There are a lot of things that can impair a level of consciousness, all those things I just stated. And then the question is, as a composite endpoint, we did have 52 patients that had no clinically evident seizures, but then didn't improve level of consciousness. And then what does that mean for our endpoints and for the seizure cessation as the endpoint alone? You know, maybe that contributes to our lower response rates overall. I will say they do try to separate this out a little bit in their supplementary appendix. They do a sub-analysis of patients who receive monotherapy versus other drugs. This honestly didn't yield a lot, but those who didn't receive additional anticonvulsants or other medications, they did tend to improve in consciousness some. And with Keppra monotherapy, maybe a little bit more, although again, there's no statistical analysis. It's not powered, so we can't really say for sure. It's also probably worth mentioning, because it's addressed in the study, that hypotension, endotracheal intubation, a little more frequent with fosphenytoin than the other two drugs, and that deaths were interesting, a little more frequent with Keppra. But I do think that none of those were significant, and we know that. And of course, we don't have all the details about every patient that we'd love to have. There was a high number of toxic encephalopathy as well. And so it's hard to know how that plays a role in things like endotracheal intubation, lack of improved level of consciousness, as well as death, you know, depending on the level, of course. Those are all speculations, but something to be considered.
I kind of agree with your take on the continuous EEG thoughts. And it feels like in my mind, this is a battle between emergency medicine and neurocritical care. Because yes, in the neuro, in NCC, right, in that world, are these patients hooked up to continuous EEG in a lot of these bigger centers? Definitely. The idea of being able to hook these patients up to continuous EEG in the ER, in a busy ER, that just is, from a pragmatic perspective, seems pretty challenging. So I'm kind of on your side of it, is sometimes that's all we have. And so from an external validity perspective, I think more people probably use those markers than EEG findings, at least in the first hour or two in the ER.
Certainly. And I know that can be challenging, and there's a lot of debate on that. And like you said, I think it's a very hot debate between the ER and neurocritical care. And the second they get up to the neuro ICU, right, you're undoubtedly going to hear at least once that, oh, this is just clonus. This isn't a true clinical seizure. And the ER docs are going, this is the best we had. And so it's an ongoing debate, but it's something, like you said, feasibly is just not really doable. And we always think of things as far as academic medical centers, right? But when you're talking about critical access hospitals and things that have to be treated quickly, they're just not going to have those resources.
Yeah, if we have a neurocritical care bingo card, the phrase you said, just clonus or things, that's probably the center space. That's the free one. You know that's going to come no matter what.
Every time.
You know, you brought up patient weights. And that's something I kind of want to get into, because when you look at the protocol, they cap the doses at 75 kilos. I'm in Indiana, right? We got Hoosiers here. 75 kilos, that's like low body weight, if anything, right? You're like, oh, wow. So do you think we would have found differences if they didn't have a dose cap per se, and we were given maybe 6 grams of Keppra rather than our 4.5 with it kind of stopped at that 75 kilos?
That's a great question. And it's one that's been asked a lot. It's really hard to tell. In theory, you would think that more is more, right? But when things like phenytoin and, in valproic acid, at least, we know that that's maybe not the case. The VA co-op trial, since we talked about it a little bit, looked at 15 phenytoin equivalents per kilogram. And what they found actually in that study is that serum concentrations were pretty good after even that dose. And so as far as capping the dose for our protein-bound drugs, it's hard to say. We've got a little more of a narrow therapeutic index to play with. And then they did do a post-hoc analysis that looked at weights over 75 kilos, which was a pretty big number as far as the study goes. I'd say about a third. And it's not as powered, obviously, but they did not find any differences. And I would think that some of that goes back to the pharmacokinetics that we talked about earlier, that it's possible that we're getting good enough levels with those two drugs. Now, the one drug I would question, which you brought up, is Keppra. And that's because we know that Keppra has linear kinetics up to 5,000 milligrams. So if some patients actually did get 5,000 milligrams, that would increase the dose cap up to 83 kilograms overall. Would they have had better responses? Again, it's kind of hard to know. Taking it back to some of the pediatrics data, there were maybe some slightly higher response rates with patients who got true weight-based dosing. And so it begs the question, right? Things that haven't been studied, again, things that also come down to practicality with increasing our doses, and what's available to us to give in a short period of time.
So we've talked about how the ESID trial included adult and pediatric patients, and we've been focusing on adult patients, right? That's who you treat. That's my patient population that I treat. But, you know, one of the things I kind of wanted to ask, because this is a concept that, you know, if you work in a mixed ER, right, of pediatrics and adults, this is something that you might need to think of or come up. But when you're researching a pharmacologic intervention like the ESID trial did with both adult and pediatric patients, are there any like administration or operational concerns from like a medication safety perspective?
Certainly. And so actually I've done medication safety at a couple hospitals I've worked at. And so this is a big question, especially for me. Like you said, I'm not a pediatric trained pharmacist. So every time I get called by the pediatric side of our ER because peds isn't there, I get very nervous. I think there's a lot to consider here when it comes to setting up your employees and your pharmacists for success. That includes having one agent for both. We know that confusion increases medication errors every time. The thing I really like about Keppra as well, now that we have evidence to support it, is it has a large therapeutic index. We just aren't as worried about side effects, infusion rates, dosing, compounding, all of those things. In most places, I'll say for compounding. But as someone who isn't formally trained, I know that when I reach for Keppra over some of these other medications, I feel so much more confident as far as giving it safely. Dosing is always going to confuse some people, but it's not any different between those three drugs because it's all weight-based. But I would say as far as giving it across two ERs, having one option is going to be better. And then always knowing when, always considering how you stock medications as well, and not having multiple choices across ERs is going to reduce your risk of error every time.
How does someone's home anti-seizure medication influence either the agent or the dose of the medication we would give acutely?
This is a great question as far as what we would do in an emergency situation. And I have read and practiced different ways. I would say that when we have a known medication and we have a caregiver nearby that can give us more information on whether or not a patient was compliant, and we know if they were stable on outpatient medications, those things all matter. There's some literature to state that patients who are on Keppra outpatient may respond less to Keppra in an emergency situation. I would also argue, however, that again, it is much more tolerated than a lot of our other antiepileptics. So as an initial agent, it's probably safe to give and then get a little more information. And that will all come into play when it comes down to thinking about how quickly we're giving antiepileptics as well, which I think is an important conversation to have. as opposed to giving benzodiazepines and waiting and waiting and waiting before we give those AEDs. But I would say that this is a pretty debated topic. I think a lot of people who know a patient is on Keppra outpatient, unless they've been noncompliant, will not reach for it first. It was one of the major causes of unblinding in this particular trial because people didn't want to do that. But I would say that reaching for something like phenytoin and valproic acid that have more potential side effects may be a little, I would probably be a little more cautious with it.
It always makes me feel good when my anecdotal practice is supported by someone smarter than me, their anecdotal practice as well. And that tends to be what I can do. Because if we don't know, if in doubt, your assumption, unless you have other info, probably needs to be they're taking this medication, right? You kind of have to do that in the acute setting and kind of go to something else. So, good point. Now let's kind of move into one of my favorite parts of the trials of the week, trial fun facts. The ESID trial had some really good ones, folks. So from a design or I guess implementation perspective, they had a use next study kit. So what that is it's this box to basically implement this protocol in an emergency setting. Because I've never done research in an emergency department, but I have to imagine that is one of the more challenging arenas. You have lots of people, lots of things happening at once. And so this kit was meant to help them. Now, when you look in the text, it says there's a protocol assist device in each study kit. And that sounds very James Bondy, Mission Impossible. It's not. It's an Apple iPod Touch. The young guns don't know about these, right? That was like that's an iPhone without a phone. This was a big deal, by the way, when this came out. I definitely had an Apple iPod Touch. So the fact that they had kits of these is a big deal. But this assisted with trial enrollment and completion. It had an app. It walked you through it. So, and talk about a pragmatic idea. Very, very cool. And then within that, they also had this, they call it the Braslow tape, but it was, so the Braslow tape is the tape you use for like a neonatal cardiac arrest, right? And it helps determine what dose you give based on the length. And this trial, what they did is they had a similar one of for children of unknown weight that helped determine the volume of the study drug to give, i.e. what dose to give them. So I thought that was really cool. When you look in the text, one of the exclusion criteria was patients who had medical tags that state ESIT declined. So I was like, man, how does that? And then when you kind of dig a little further, they gave these out as part of the trial. Because obviously, if you're having seizure issues, you might come to the ER more than once in this long time frame. So ESIT declined medical alert tag, I thought was funny. And then the last thing, this trial had a maximum sample size. I'm not sure I've ever seen that before. We obviously know minimal sample size and requirements. Now, maybe there's some smart statistics people that are like, well, of course, maximum sample size. And if you want to like nerd out on these statistics, go to the supplementary protocol. There are pages describing the statistics that we do not want to listen to in an audio format. But some fun facts talking about kind of the implementation and some of the things within the ESIT trial. Now let's talk about where are we now, Ashley? And we've kind of hinted at this, but you know, the trial didn't show a difference between these agents. Seizure cessation, improving level of consciousness, it was less than 50% for all patients, right? You couldn't even say there's a numerical difference there. Why does it feel like this was a practice-changing trial though? Why does it feel like despite all that, this is a really important trial, one especially neurocritical care that most know and are familiar with?
I would say it probably feels like a practice-changing trial because it probably is. First of all, it's one of the first trials we've had in a long time, at least on the adult side, looking head-to-head at anti-epileptics and trying to figure out if there's one better than another. The second is that it probably has changed practice. Again, we've probably been using Keppra for a while and just getting yelled at by neurologists for using it first line when maybe phenytoin was preferred. But now we've got a little more ammo to reach for it. The other thing I've seen is a change in dosing. So anecdotally, before ESET came out, we would give a gram, maybe 1500 milligrams, maybe 2 grams if we felt real adventurous. But anything over that was kind of unheard of, at least for me. And so I've been seeing bigger doses. Now, in my particular ER, we have the pre-mixed bags of 1500. So we usually at least give somewhere between 3 and 4.5 grams. I think the other big thing that ESET gives us is a place to go, especially with some of the new literature coming out with IV push Keppra. And I've been holding back as long as I can throughout this whole talk to talk about IV push Keppra. But I know you just talked to Dr. Morgan about this recently, where they looked at retrospective administration of at least a gram of Keppra, mostly for prophylaxis. But I know that there's also more literature looking at, I think it's up to 4 grams IV push. And so if we can get anything larger than a 500 milligram per 5 mL vial, I know you guys made your plea. I'm here to second that plea to get larger vials for easier administration. I think that would be a real place for us to go with research is giving this IV push, getting it faster. Does all that really make a difference in our seizure cessation?
Appreciate the plug. We need to shout that from the mountaintops that we need bigger than 5 mL vials. We need the whole world to be behind us for change to happen. So we will take anyone on our on our platform that we can.
Yes, I'm here to support.
You know, you mentioned the Rampart trial, and Rampart and ESET are probably two of the major trials in seizure and status epilepticus treatment. So what did the neurocritical care world learn from, you know, definitely the ESET and maybe even the Ramparts? It feels like they're kind of like linked, like an if-then statement in a sense.
I certainly agree. I think the big takeaway from both of these trials combined, but particularly having the ESET come after the Rampart and seeing the protocol deviations that happened, is treat early and treat it like you mean it. We need to stop giving these half doses out of fear that we're going to have to intubate these patients. And again, we talked about this a little bit, but endotracheal intubation varies so much practice to practice that it's not a great endpoint for us to be looking at in terms of status epilepticus. But what we know is that the longer people seize, the more their mortality increases and the more likely they are to just get intubated down the line. And so we should treat early with benzos, treat it like we mean it. We should treat early with whatever agent. I'm pretty much team Keppra at this point, but treat early and give a real dose. And the other thing, I'm really interested to see how this actually affects our guidelines moving forward, particularly with timing of medications. And I think Rampart and ESET have given us more information on that. I don't fault ESET really for having an hour long time to enrollment. I think a lot of people want to, but if you actually look at the way the guidelines are outlined, it's not that far off. Now, is that in line with what a lot of us are doing? Probably not. At least anecdotally for us, we pretty much give the benzos. And if they hit the door and they're still seizing, we give more benzos and we give an antiepileptic. We don't wait for them to keep seizing to see what happens.
You know, the Keppra vial size, I feel, is like getting all the publicity. But I also feel like if lorazepam was a 4 milligram vial and not a 2 milligram vial, we would probably get influenced of better doses. I don't know why, but it feels like when you do greater than one vial, people get nervous. So I'm just saying, if we're going to make changes to Keppra, we might as well just try to take all of our drugs and get them in our ad. Let's get midazolam in 10 milligrams, right? Let's do those things. Cause I feel like if you have to ask for 2 vials, instantly someone gets hesitating, right? Just hearing 2 versus 1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point that I hadn't actually thought of, but it is so true that it is actually, it's something that we sometimes say to people is if you're drawing up more than one vial, you should probably look twice at it. And maybe that's not supposed to be the case in here.
So if we designed a new study, right, Ashley, you're the lead investigator, what would be the 3 anti-seizure medications you'd use? Would you use the same? Would you replace one or more of them?
Yeah, so I would actually replace 2 of them. If I were going to design a trial, there are 3 drugs that I'm really interested in. The first is, of course, Keppra. And I would use higher doses. And if we could get bigger vials, once again, I would do IV push dosing. And I think that's an important part of this, is that I want to look at Keppra, high dose IV push. The second drug I really am interested in is lacosamide or Vimpat. This can also be given IV push over 5 minutes in doses up to 400 milligrams. So that's really promising. It has some preliminary data to support its use and shows it's effective. And it overall has a pretty low side effect rate. There's some concerns with PR prolongation. But other than that, it's pretty well tolerated. My third drug is maybe a little bit of a hot take, but I'm a little more curious than anything to see how this pans out is brivaracetam or Briviact. At least in some places, I feel like this has had a little bit of a resurgence recently. And there's some old data looking at this, but as of the last maybe 5 years or so, I've been hearing about it a lot more. It's really thought to have about 15 to 30 times greater affinity for this SV2A receptor. Really, what that probably means is it has a little bit less agitation, which is always a concern for people. But in the acute phase, how much does that matter? I don't really know. But probably of interest is it is proposed to permeate the brain a lot faster than levetiracetam. So again, how does that pan out clinically? We talked about pharmacokinetics affecting clinical outcomes. We don't know the answer to that, and it's something I'd sort of like to know the answer to, because if we can also give those things IV push and it's pretty well tolerated, you know, that's kind of where I would like to head with my study.
Yeah, you know, I think lacosamide is the new levetiracetam, the drug that we like that neurologists say, well, we don't have the good data to support it, right? So lacosamide kind of slid into yeah. that spot as the new one. So I completely agree. I love those ideas. Got to end with this. All right, in your opinion, what's the best anti-seizure medication for status epilepticus? Can't say a benzo, though. Can't, because we know that. You've already, that's power ranked number one. But what about right underneath them?
Yeah, so if I'm not choosing a benzo, then it's going to be levetiracetam for me as far as an anti-epileptic drug. And I've said this a couple times, but ultimately, I think with the evidence that we have that they're all equally good or equally bad, however you want to look at it. I think if you're thinking about what's the safest and easiest to give, especially when you consider that there are a lot of critical access hospitals out there without pharmacy support, without all the nursing support that we have to compound, to make sure infusion rates are correct, to make sure that we're dosing it correctly. I just think it's really our best option. I think that the biggest barrier we may have is historical precedence. But as we've previously discussed, we used to give a gram over 30 minutes, you know, or 15 to 30 minutes. We are now telling people to give four times that over a portion of the time. And I really think that that will make a difference.
Yeah, the biggest thing with that is that's probably the one in most cases that we can give the quickest with that data that you're talking about, right? And that's one of our big important things. Mm-hmm. So I love that. And I got to ask, we'd be remiss, Ashley, you're out in Colorado and Denver, and despite you all getting dumped with snow about 10 to 14 days ago, in most places it's actually spring, getting into hiking season. So you're in a peak area for that. So what's your favorite hike in the area? Are you hopping on a 14er? Are we going to the Rocky Mountain National Parks? Are we going to Boulder? Where's our spot?
Yeah. So first I want to address the fact that we did get a ton of snow. And as someone who moved from Hawaii to Denver, I'm actually really cranky about that. And I've had friends that lived here previously all texting me like, we know you're mad about the snow. Try not to be. It's so pretty. And I'm pretty cranky about it. That being said, it is very beautiful. It is very sunny here. When we're able to take hikes, we really like to take the whole family. So I have a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old daughter. And we love to go to Bear Creek as a family. It's a very easy trail, but there's a lot to be seen along the trail as far as nature goes and animals. And there's a great little stream that they can hop in. And so that's probably our favorite hike right now.
You mentioned a 4 and 7-year-old. Man, when kids grow up out there, they have something different in their blood in terms of climbing and hiking. They will humble you so quickly. You'll have these just small children rushing past you or just climbing with no concern at all. It's like when you're doing a marathon and you see grandma passing you on the left, a very similar feeling.
Yeah, I will tell you that we took them skiing and snowboarding for the first time, and it was the first time I'd ever snowboarded, and that's what they wanted to do. So we took lessons. And I am falling all over the place. And I look over, and my 7-year-old, who was 6 at the time, is going off a ramp and does a switch and lands on the other side. And it's her first time. I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool.
Every person needs an MVP of the lodge. That's my role typically. That sounds like that might be your role too in a ski trip, lodge MVP. But no, in all seriousness, Ashley, this was awesome. I appreciate you coming on, giving perspective into such an important trial, but a trial that has a lot to kind of unpack and talk through and talk about how we take that into what we do now. So appreciate you coming on in the very limited free time and all the things you're doing. So thank you so much.
Certainly. Thank you for having me.
Another huge thanks to Ashley. This was awesome. She's not on X, but you can find her on Instagram. I'll have her tagged in the promo posts. Be sure to have a look at that reference list, right? It includes PubMed links to all the articles we discussed in today's episode. It's available in the podcast episode description as well as the website pharmacy2dose.com. Find me on social media at pharmacy2dose, T-O-2-dose, pharmacy2dose@gmail.com via email. If you want to get in touch with me, love hearing from everybody. But until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only. Does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials on the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. Users or patients should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACP or the Critical Care PRN. ACP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.